heavily criticised for harsher restrictions and penalties on areas with migrants and low incomes. Robert Inlakesh, we cannot escape the two major stories of the day, especially if you are of faith or, in fact, none. Could you kick us off with your first choice, please?
The first one we're going to look at here is Sir Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party at this time, defending the suspension of Jeremy Corbyn over anti-Semitism and this new anti-Semitism report that has come out. And basically what we've seen from this is that the coup is complete of removing Jeremy Corbyn, also his allies from the Labour Party. And what we need to understand about this is that it is little to do with anti-Semitism, as it has been pointed out online, and more to do with basically people who are anti-war, who are pro-Palestinian, who are anti-corporations, who want socialist-leaning policies to go through. And so we see that the Blairite establishment inside of the Labour Party has conspired against Jeremy Corbyn and his allies. And of course, Zionist supporters of Israel inside of the United Kingdom, have conjured up these claims of anti-Semitism. They first did that, and then the entire establishment jumped on board to push this line because it was a stick to beat Jeremy Corbyn and his allies with. And he got too close, I believe that's what they viewed in their opinion. He got too close to a position of power, having someone who is going to implement socialist policies, someone who is going to be holding Israel accountable for its war crimes. And so, of course, they pull out the anti-Semitism stick to beat him with. Ultimately, what this is going to do is this is going to cause more anti-Semitism, because what they do is they conflate anti-Zionism and anti-Israel sentiment with anti-Semitism. And, of course, when you do that, you sort of blur the lines, and so people see that it's all sort of free for all on Jewish people at this point, because they say, well, it doesn't really exist at this point. That's what it does. It brings forward anti-Semitism, and when you start claiming that Israel represents all Jewish people, then all the crimes of Israel are put onto Jewish people.
Let's be very clear about this. Jeremy Corbyn was not suspended from the Labour Party because of any of the actions highlighted in this report, but because he didn't walk back the comments he made in reference to this report and the original claims here, and he stood by that decision. What makes this so unique in your own mind, Robert Inlakesh, about the reason, the very scurrilous, tenuous reason that I believe he's been singled out for and suspended?
Well, what makes this so severe is the fact that anybody who is going to speak up on Palestinian rights now has to extra police their language when it comes to the issue. And we're talking about the most racist regime on earth when we're talking about Israel. We're talking about a regime which is ethnically cleansing people, which takes a racist anti-Islam line on pretty much every single issue, and is murdering people and committing an ongoing incremental genocide in the case of the Gaza Strip. So when we talk about racism, there is no place which is worse when it comes to racism than Israel. But now we're having to police our language here in the United Kingdom for fear, especially in the Labour Party now, for fear of offending people who are racist. So that is one of the biggest takeaways from this, is that if you are going to stand up for Palestinian rights, you are going to have your political career taken away from you. If you're a journalist, you're going to be silenced. Your life is going to be destroyed. You're going to be smeared as a racist for being an anti-racist.
The irony has not escaped us. What's been the online reaction, Rob?
The first one we pulled up here is from low-key political rapper. He says, "This is the coup. Where do you stand?" We've got another one commenting here as well from Hamid on Twitter. He says, "The fake world we live in. If you criticize the brutal Israeli government and support Palestinians and their freedom to fight anti-Semitism, and in France, the French president's remarks about Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and Islam is fine and allowed, is part of freedom of speech." We got another one here as well from Gemma Bolton, who says, "I'm shocked by the actions of an unelected party official to suspend the former leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn. It must be lifted immediately if elected to the NEC. I'll table a notion to overturn Jeremy's suspension at our first meeting."
Just a quick kind of devil's advocate position here. Do you sincerely believe that Sir Keir Starmer felt he had no option but to make a token gesture here? So he suspends Jeremy Corbyn, there is a hearing, Jeremy Corbyn is reinstated, we consider the matter closed and we move on.
Well, he's benefited directly from this coup of Jeremy Corbyn, and when it comes to it, I mean, he wouldn't want to feel a full victim to a coup himself if he was to take similar positions to that of Jeremy Corbyn. So being implicated in it, of course, he has a vested interest in pushing this. And on top of that, when it comes down to it, and looking like at the issues of anti-Semitism, why isn't he looking at the issues of Islamophobia or anti-black racism inside the Labour Party? Because all of these issues are going on. There are individuals, members of the Labour Party, who do say anti-Semitic, anti-black, anti-Muslim things all the time. We know this. This is just something which exists. And so why single out anti-Semitism and do all this gesturing, this over-the-top gesturing, by getting rid of Jeremy Corbyn?
All right, so we move from Islamophobia, anti-Palestine sentiments, claims of anti-Semitism, and we go over to France, where we talk about Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, and other issues. I mean, bring it up to speed for us, Rob.
Of course, everyone watching this is probably familiar with what is currently going down in France in terms of the crackdown on Muslims throughout the country. Of course, there was the terrorist attack yesterday as well. And this has only heightened the far-right extremism against Muslims inside of France. But the question that's being pulled up here is, why is it that anti-Semitism is completely unacceptable, as it should be, inside of France? For instance, you can't deny the Holocaust inside of France. And, you know, they say it's freedom of opinion and all things, but on this you cannot have freedom of opinion. So if you have one rule for one group of people, why is it that in the case of Muslims it seems to be a free-for-all? Even the Armenian genocide also is an offense to deny it. We know that France, they try and say that there's a separation of religion and state, but yet Emmanuel Macron has basically weaponized the hatred of Muslims in the country, so politicized religion inside of the country for a political aim. So he's actually using religion in the name of getting rid of religion out of politics and stopping extremism. He's causing more extremism on the right. He's isolating Muslims more. It's open season. On top of this, if we're talking about freedom of speech, why are they pushing anti-BDS legislation? Why are they stopping pro-Palestinian human rights rallies, for instance, like they've done in the past? And so there is a double standard which exists there, which many people are pointing out. If you have one rule for one group of people, why do you have another rule for another group of people? Do you have a fully secular state when you can go out and do these sort of things for one group of people but not the other? I mean, what are the principles that you are sticking by? You have to be consistent.
So you believe a lot of this inconsistency is about Macron recognizing that there are votes to be won here.
Absolutely. It seems that that is the case in the country, that he's playing to a base. And he's using Muslims at the moment, and he's cracking down on Muslims. And we see the reaction worldwide from this. If he wanted to stop violence, both against Muslims by far-right extremists and also from extremists who identify as Muslim, who are going to attack the French public, why do the things that he's been doing? You are putting the French people in a position where it's more likely that they're going to be attacked, whether they be Muslim or non-Muslim, from either side of this. You are exacerbating the issue when before it wasn't existing there. Where were these attacks months ago, before this whole thing happened, before he delivered his speech talking about Islam is in crisis and Islamist separatists, in his words, in the country, and talking about cracking down and then endorsing these insulting depictions of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him? It didn't exist before this at such a large scale, but now he's exacerbating the issue, and he's putting his own population in harm's way, as well as his own Muslim population in harm's way, and targeting them.
Indeed. Quick social media reaction here, Robert.
First one we have here says, Islamophobic violence, Muslims in France. right now are being beaten and stabbed because the president decided to blame all Muslims for someone's crimes. He even mocked our prophet. A lot of mosques are being taken down, etc. And there's no media coverage about this at all. We got another one here as well from Pam OB, a Twitter account. They say, I think it's very important for Muslims to denounce the Nice attacks. All Muslims need to apologize. And in reply to that, we have another one here from Yasser who says, using that logic, please condemn the Iraq War, slavery, the Vietnam War, European occupation of Africa, drone strikes, ethnic cleansing of Native Americans, etc.
Indeed. Strong words. Thank you very much, Robert. And that is where we leave the broadcast for tonight. Good night.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. The limelight.
Dismissing glaring concerns about voter intimidation, a Michigan judge on Tuesday, October 27th, struck down a directive from the Secretary of State banning the open carry of firearms at polling places on Election Day. The Associated Press reports Michigan Court of Claims Judge Christopher Murray granted a preliminary injunction in favor of gun rights advocates who had filed a lawsuit challenging an October 16 order from Democratic Secretary of State Jacqueline Benson declaring a universal ban on the open carry of guns within 100 feet of polling places on November 3rd. Armed far-right groups including the Oath Keepers and QAnon conspiracies have said they will heed Trump's call for an army of supporters to go into the polls and watch very carefully, which many observers say is nothing less than an endorsement of, if not a rallying call for, illegal voter intimidation. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Michigan Judge Accused of Jeopardizing Safety and Democracy with Reversal of Open Carry Ban at Polling Places. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Dismissing glaring concerns about voter intimidation, a Michigan judge on Tuesday, October 27th, struck down a directive from the Secretary of the State banning the open carry of firearms at polling places on Election Day. The Associated Press reports Michigan Court of Claims Judge Christopher Murray granted a preliminary injunction in favor of gun rights advocates who had filed a lawsuit challenging an October 16th order from Democratic Secretary of State Jacqueline Benson declaring a universal ban on the open carry of guns within 100 feet of polling places on November 3rd. The injunction does not apply to places such as schools or churches that already prohibit open carry. Benson had argued that the ban was needed to deter voter intimidation in the wake of the revelation of a plot by far-right militia members who are supporters of President Donald Trump, to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, a Democrat. However, Murray asserted that Benson was attempting to create a new administrative rule without following the proper procedures. It is important to recognize that this case is not about whether it is a good idea to openly carry a firearm at polling place or whether the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution prevents the Secretary of State's directive, Murray wrote in his opinion. The court's duty is not to act as an overseer of the Michigan Department of State, nor it is to impose its view on the wisdom of openly carrying firearms at polling places or other election locations, wrote Murray. More importantly, its constitutional role is properly limited to only declaring what the law is, not what it should be. The secretary just didn't do this in the right way and at the right time, Murray said, adding that if she wanted to ban open carry at polling places, she should have done this months ago. The Detroit Free Press reports the state assistant attorney general Heather Mangast countered concerns regarding guns at polling places weren't as prevalent months ago as they are now, especially in light of the plot to kidnap the governor. Mangast said that now there are voters who are afraid. There are election workers who are afraid. Benson and Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel, also a Democrat, vowed to appeal Murray's injunction. As the state's chief elections officer, I have sworn duty to protect every voter and the right to cast a ballot free from intimidation and harassment, Benson said. I will continue to protect that right in Michigan. Armed far-right groups, including the Oath Keepers and QAnon conspiracists, have said they will heed Trump's call for an army of supporters to go into the polls and watch very carefully, which many observers say is nothing less than an endorsement of, if not a rallying call for, illegal voter intimidation. Stephen Gardiner, a scholar at the progressive think tank Political Research Associates, told The Guardian earlier this month that the militias will absolutely seize on Trump's comments. The possibility of armed factions with military-style rifles showing up at polling places is very troubling, Gardner said.
The debate.
In the latest UN report on Yemen, it has been revealed that Yemeni children have suffered record rates of acute malnutrition, putting an entire generation at risk. The war in Yemen, now entering its sixth year, continues to claim lives, especially those of children suffering acute malnutrition at unprecedented rates. Has the international reaction been enough, as funding has fallen far short of what is needed to offset the effects of the conflict? And also, what about the economic collapse that has ensued? In this edition of The Debate, we will look at why the world looks on as Saudi Arabia continues this war with the U.S. support. Okay, let's start with our correspondent first to find out the latest about the situation in Yemen. We have Abdul Al-Awashedi, who joins us from the capital, Sana'a. This report by the UN, can you please tell us more about the depth of how the Yemeni children are suffering, and then expand more as to how, under the COVID-19, Yemen in general is coping with the pandemic?
As you know, a report, or UN report, says that acute malnutrition is spreading among children, and severe acute malnutrition is has increased this year and about 15%. So we have a lot of problems in Yemen because of the war, because of the Saudi coalition and their siege upon Yemenis. Yemen is approaching a dire food security crisis. 80% of the people in Yemen are suffering, and they're depending on any form of help from organizations, from UN organizations. So UN knows what is happening in Yemen. They know how the humanitarian situation is getting worse and worse each day. They didn't do anything to or for Yemenis. Instead, they have removed the name of Saudi Arabia from the blacklist of children killers.
Okay, very good. Thank you. We appreciate that. That's our correspondent, Abdul Latif Al-Awashedi there, talking to us from Yemen's capital, Sana'a. Let me introduce our guests. We have Elijah Magnier, who's a journalist and political analyst, joining us from Brussels. We also have Michael Springman, former U.S. diplomat in Saudi Arabia, who joins us from Washington, D.C. I'd like to welcome you both. And Elijah, if I may first start with you. This U.N. report is quite alarming. It should somewhat have been anticipated, but the depth of it maybe is not something that's very well known. And I'll start out with the first part of this report that we have picked out as a highlight, for Yemeni children suffering record rates of acute malnutrition. And this is the part that needs to be highlighted, putting an entire generation at risk. Do you find this surprising and shocking at the same time, given the fact that you're looking at a war that is now into the sixth year?
Yemen was declared the world's largest humanitarian disaster by the United Nations. And it is, the UN estimate 80% of the population, that is around 24 million people, requiring some form of humanitarian protection assistance, including 14.3 million who are in acute need. So we're talking about two-thirds of all districts in Yemen of the country are already in pre-famine. We're talking also about an impossible situation described by all humanitarian UN organizations that are on the ground, and they describe it as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, yet we don't have the resources, the need to save the people who are suffering and who are continuously dying. And then also there is the COVID pandemic that is spreading. There are 3,500 hospitals and medical facilities in the country, but only half of these facilities are functioning. That means the country population of around 24 million will have no access to adequate health care. Now, the point is, and here is quite an hypocrisy, is I've been in Bosnia during the war, and we see the international community very happy to invest billions of dollars and euros supporting humanitarian support, help to the population, but not to stop the war. So we saw in 2019, the international community spent $2.6 billion in aid operation. In 2020, they spent only $558 million. And in 5 years of conflict, this is going to cost the international community $29 billion. Now, if we add these 29 billions to almost 100 billion spent by the Saudis, and rather than waging war on Yemen, we invested in constructing the country, we will have the richest and the most beautiful country in the world. And that is the hypocrisy. And this is where it is quite shocking to continue accepting war crimes happening every single day by the Saudis, and yet this is our best Western ally.
This takes a rather new turn to the conversation. So let me ask you, if I may, Michael Springman. Our guest highlights a very important point when it comes to the finances. You know, when you take a look at the humanitarian help that has come through, even though it hasn't helped as much as it should, and even though it hasn't been enough. We're going to talk about that shortly. In terms of the ratio, you're looking at Saudi Arabia to spend almost five times as much on the war itself. And this could have, in the meantime, made Yemen one of the most, not one, but a prosperous nation within its own ranks. So why is Saudi Arabia spending the kind of money that it is on this war, do you think?
Well, it's gotten itself into a hole that it can't get out of. It has invested so much time, money, and effort into trying to destroy Yemen that it simply doesn't want to back out of it. It wants to continue on. It wants to save face. It wants to shore up the apparent Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and his position there, and to show that he's really doing something for Saudi Arabia, when in fact he's not. And I think that behind a lot of this that's not brought out into the open is Israel, the apartheid entity. They have uncovered caches of Israeli weapons and ammunition. They found documents saying that the American government wants to work with Israel to control Purim Island near the Bab al-Mandeb to ensure the safety and security of Israel. Israel has in the past repeatedly intervened in Yemen on one side or another. Israel has warships patrolling the waters around Yemen, and Israel is conducts a very good relations or has great friendship with the Southern Transitional Council, which is backed by the United Arab Emirates terrorist group. So they are there, and nobody dares gainsay the Israelis because they control just about everything that happens internationally these days. They didn't even approve the sale of American weapons to the United Arab Emirates. Not the American Congress, mind you, but Israel.
So what do you think of that, Elijah Magnier, the Israeli role in the war in Yemen? I mean, is there something there that, as our guest indicated, to secure the safety of Israel, which plays a part in this war?
Well, I think Israel is today the ally of Saudi Arabia, the ally of the Emirates, and there is a normalization of the situation between the two countries, and the Saudis are still hesitant to declare it. Therefore, this relationship and the involvement of the Saudis and the Emiratis in the war in Yemen, when the Emiratis themselves say that we are on very high level of cooperation with the Israelis on intelligence and military levels, they are indeed cooperating in Yemen, and they are present with the Israelis in Yemen. And it is in the interest of Israel to control Bab al-Mandeb and to control all the maritime way, particularly trying to turn the enemy today in the Middle East from being Israel to being Iran. And they think by countering Iran and countering Yemen, that will help them to submit Iran in one way or another. That's why the Israelis are indeed present in multiple stages. They are present in Syria, where the Americans are occupying the northeast and using the American occupation forces facilities to bomb Iraq, as the U.S. ambassador said. They are trying to create havoc in Lebanon on the borders and centralization. So they want to be present in Yemen as they want to be present along with the Saudis and along with the Emiratis. That definitely.
We need to take a look at the arms sales, Michael Springman, if we can. Now, what is very ironic about this is that you are looking at, for example, this one headline reading, a deadly concoction of arms sales conflict at COVID-19, in which you have a catastrophe, humanitarian-wise, that's fueled by Western arms shipments. And according to this one report, is getting much worse. The irony, and I'd like to get your reaction on this, is that most of these arms come first from the U.S., followed by the U.K., France, Spain, Italy, Germany, and Canada. And yet you have some of these countries that are the veto-wielding members of the U.N. who publicly say, hey, let's go for a ceasefire. Please stop this war. But then they're selling arms. So isn't that a double standard somewhat in play?
Certainly it is. These people are morons. And they are some of the countries listed that you just mentioned are some of the most hypocritical countries going. Germany always bleats about how it wants peace, and yet it supports the American wars of aggression in the Middle East. Canada keeps going on and on about how they are neutral, they are a small country, they want to be a force for peace, yet their government is firmly in the grip of the apartheid entity and is oppressing the Palestinians in Canada and doing its best to oppress the Palestinians in Palestine. So I think that hypocritical is probably a mild word to use for it. These are the people that are really responsible for the deaths of the children and the generation that's supposedly trying to grow up in the midst of starvation and disease and so forth. Yet they don't recognize reality and refuse to recognize reality. They prefer to hide behind their mask of, oh, yes, we're trying to help. We're talking about trying to help, and we're saying all kinds of good and wonderful things. But in actual fact, we're not going to take one step towards putting an end to this mess in Yemen, because it would hurt our businessmen and hurt our businesses and hurt our politicians.
I can't help but to ask you about how once Elijah Magnier, the U.S. president, referred to Saudi Arabia as milking the cow when it comes to arms sales. So how much of this is what this conflict is all about, especially when you have not only the U.S., but other countries that are selling Saudi Arabia arms, along with the UAE and whatever is left of the coalition?
Well, if we look at arms sales, it should be bound to international law. So any country accused of war crime should not be provided with weapons from the Western countries. And if you look at the Saudi-led coalition and its allies, they are documented responsible for the highest civilian fatalities from direct targeting. Human Rights Watch documented at least 90 unlawful coalition airstrikes on homes, markets, hospitals, schools, and mosques, and other civilian buses. We're talking about wedding, we're talking about the gathering of children. But on the other hand, we see the Americans are saying very clearly, we don't want to lose the Saudi money, and we want to provide them with the weapons they need. So they continue to killing people in Yemen. We know that they are killing honest, innocent people in Yemen, but yet we don't want to give up on the money they are providing. We look at the UK. UK, they say we are examining, and they try to use all these very beautiful English word from the dictionary to soften the way to put Saudis away from being accused of war crime, and just only to provide them with the weapons they need, by looking at if there are historical breaches or if there are possible violation or pattern. What do they want more than UN documenting all these violations? And all the NGOs on the ground are saying, these are the pictures, these are the documents, and the Saudi-led coalition is really bombing civilians, and you should stop arming them. And instead of financing all these, investing all these billions to wage the war and continue the war, stop providing Saudis with weapons, and sit around the table like they've done in Stockholm 2018, and then in Riyadh 2019, we had this good news of releasing 1,018 prisoners, but then everything has stopped, and we're back as business as usual.
Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Michael Springman, has been named as one of the most dangerous threats to U.S. national security. This goes back years ago. But yet you have, in the year 2019, a report that came out that AP did a special investigation on, saying that Saudi Arabia and the UAE are giving U.S. arms to al-Qaeda-linked groups, and they are fighting with al-Qaeda on the ground in order to beat the Ansar al-fighters. So we can see how this can actually backfire, but yet the thirst for beating the Ansar al-fighters, which they have been unsuccessful of doing, is coming at any cost, it appears. Does the U.S. realize what game it's getting itself into, which at this point we don't know if it's still continuing or not?
Well, given the fact that the U.S. has been working with terrorist organizations ever since the beginning of the war against the Soviet Union with the Mujahideen, I think the U.S. does indeed know what's going on, and it does indeed know that it is training and supporting and giving weapons to these people. and what they're doing with them. I think it's a pretend war in many instances, as I mentioned to some extent in my book, Visas for Al-Qaeda. But I think also that the U.S. doesn't really care. It likes to manufacture dangers and conflicts and threats to American existence, even if it comes from half a world away and has nothing at all to do with the United States or the American people. However, its fear is always good. It used to be the Soviet Union that was the source of the fear. Then it was communism in general. Then it was terrorists, and then it was terrorists in particular, and then terrorists in specific areas, and so on and so forth. But you can't justify this huge American military arms budget for its war machine. You can't justify the fortunes that are fueling the operation of the Central Intelligence Agency and the other American intelligence services. You can't justify the clampdown on personal liberties in the United States unless you have enemies somewhere. And like the Roman Empire, if there aren't enemies, then the United States will manufacture them either by attacking some country and creating a counterattack, or it will imagine that something is happening and claim that this is really an attack. So it's something that's been running through American politics for, well, since the end of the war, 75 years ago.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. That was Michael Springman, former U.S. diplomat in Saudi Arabia. Thank you, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst from Brussels, and Abdul Latif Al Wasadi, who was our correspondent, who spoke to us at the top of the hour. Thank you for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikko Vitale, the entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
There will be, of course, an election day, and it could be one of tumult, banners colliding, incidents at the polls, and attempt at hacks galore. More likely than not, it will end without a winner named, or at least generally accepted. America will probably awaken on 4th of November into uncertainty. Whatever else happens, there is no doubt that President Trump is ready for it. I've spent the last month interviewing some 24 officials and aides, some of whom are still serving in the Trump administration. The central sources in this story are or were senior officials, mainly in jobs that require Senate confirmation. They have had regular access to President Donald Trump and to briefings at the highest level. As a rule, they asked for anonymity, because they were taking a significant professional and in some cases personal risk in speaking out in a way that Donald Trump will see as disloyal, an offense for which he has promised to make offenders pay. The article you're about to hear has been written by Ron Susskind, an investigative journalist with more than 3 decades' experience writing for the New York Times. The piece is titled "The Day After Election Day: Current and Former Trump Administration Officials Are Worried About What Might Happen on 4th of November." Stay with us for more of Ron Susskind's article. There will, of course, be an election day, and it could be one of tumult, banners colliding, incidents at the polls, and attempted hacks galore. More likely than not, it will end without a winner named, or at least generally accepted. America will probably awaken on 4th of November into uncertainty. Whatever else happens, there is no doubt that President Trump is ready for it. I've spent the last month interviewing some 24 officials and aides, several of whom are still serving in the Trump administration. The central sources in this article are or were senior officials, mainly in jobs that require Senate confirmation. They have had regular access to President Donald Trump and to briefings at the highest level. As a rule, they asked for anonymity because they were taking a significant professional risk, and in some cases personal risk, in speaking out in a way that Donald Trump will see as disloyal, an offense for which he has promised to make offenders pay. Several of them are in current posts in intelligence, law enforcement, or national security, and are focused on the concurrent activities of violent far-right and white supremacy groups that have been encouraged by the president's words and actions. They are worried that the president could use the power of the government, the one they all serve or served within, to keep himself in office, or to create favorable terms for negotiating his exit from the White House. Like many other experts inside and outside of the government, they're also concerned about foreign adversaries using the internet to sow chaos, exacerbate divisions, and undermine America's democracy. Many of those adversaries, they report, are already finding success in simply amplifying and directing the president's words and tweets. And they're thoroughly delighted, a former top intelligence official told me, at how profoundly divided we've become. Donald Trump capitalized on that. He didn't invent it, but someday soon we're going to have to figure out how to bring our country together, because right now we're on a dangerous path, so very dangerous and so vulnerable to bad actors. None of these officials know what will happen in the future any better than the rest of us do. It is their job to fret over worst-case scenarios, and they're damn good at it. I can't know all their motives for wanting to speak to me, but one thing many of them share is a desire to make clear that the alarm bells held across the country are ringing loudly inside the administration too, where there are public servants looking to avert conflict at all costs. It is possible, of course, that this will be an election day much like all other election days. Even if it takes weeks or months before the result is known and fully certified, it could be a peaceful process where all votes are reasonably counted, allowing those precious electors to be distributed based on a fair fight. The anxiety we're feeling now could turn out to be a lot of fretting followed by nothing much, a political version of Y2K. Or not, of course. Many of those officials I spoke to came back to one idea. You don't know Donald Trump like we do. Even though they can't predict exactly what will happen, their concerns range from the president welcoming then leveraging foreign interference in the election to encouraging havoc that grows into conflagrations that would merit his calling upon US forces, US military forces. Because he's now surrounded by loyalists, they say, there is no one to try to tell an impulsive man what he should or shouldn't do. That guy you saw in the debate, a second former senior intelligence official told me after the first presidential debate, when the president offered one of the most astonishing performances of any leader in modern American history, bullying, ridiculing, manic boasting, fabricating, relentlessly interrupting and talking over his opponent, that's really him, not the myth that he's been created. That's Trump. Still another senior government official who spent years working in proximity to Donald Trump put it like this. He has done nothing else that's a constant except for acting in his own interest. And that's how he's going to be thinking every step of the way come 3rd of November. One of the first things that senior staff members learned about President Donald Trump was that he was all but unbriefable. He couldn't seem to take in complex information about policy choices and consequences in the ways presidents usually do in the Oval Office. What they saw instead was a guy from the first debate. He'd switch subjects, go on crazy tangents, abuse and humiliate people, cut them off mid-sentence. Officials I interviewed described this scenario again and again. In the middle of the briefing, Donald Trump would turn away and grab the phone. Sometimes the call would go on to Fox television hosts like Sean Hannity or Lou Dobbs. Sometimes the officials wouldn't even know who was on the other end of the phone, but whoever it was would instantly become the key voice in the debate. In one meeting about the border wall, Donald Trump called a person who built a flagpole at one of his golf courses, said an official in attendance that day. Mr. Trump explained that because this person got in a big fight about the size of the flagpole and because it was really big, the president thought, of course, they would understand how to build a wall. Obviously, this official said, it is not the same. We used to joke that it was like a phone-a-friend thing, a lifeline thing, from Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, this person said. Soon senior officials, frustrated that they couldn't seem to get a word in during briefings, adopted their own version of this technique. They'd ask an array of people, some Trump friends, some members of Congress, assorted notables, to call Mr. Trump and talk to him about key issues. The callers just couldn't let on that a senior official had put them up to it. Two of these senior officials compared the technique to the manipulation of The Truman Show, in which the main character, played by Jim Carrey, does not know that his entire life is being orchestrated by a television producer. In February 2019, William Barr arrived as Attorney General, having auditioned for the job with a 19-page memo, arguing in various and creative ways that the president's powers should be exercised nearly without limits, and his actions stand virtually beyond review. He stood ready to brilliantly manage the receipt of the Mueller report in March. William Barr's move constituted what amounted to a clean kill, decapitating the sprawling nearly two-year investigation led by his old friend with a single blow. That summer, two more heavyweight senior officials, Dan Coats, the Director of National Intelligence, and his deputy Sue Gordon, a beloved 32-year veteran of the CIA, both resigned. To replace Dan Coats, Donald Trump selected Representative John Ratcliffe of Texas, a small-town mayor turned congressman with no meaningful experience in intelligence. who quickly withdrew from consideration after news reports questioned his qualifications for the post. He lacked support among key Republican senators as well. Donald Trump then picked a communications official in the administration of George W. Bush and ambassador to Germany under Mr. Trump, Richard Grenell. Richard Grenell's stint was temporary, and in May, Donald Trump brought back his first choice, Mr. Ratcliffe, who is now Director of National Intelligence, for Mr. Trump's home stretch and post-election period. In other words, by the summer of 2020, Donald Trump was well along in completing the transition to a loyalty-tested senior team. When I asked the White House to respond to this idea, I heard back from Sarah Matthews, a deputy press secretary at the White House. President Trump serves the American people by keeping his promises and taking action where a typical politician would provide hollow words, she said. The president wants capable public servants in his administration who will enact his America First agenda and are faithful to the Constitution. These principles are not mutually exclusive. President Trump is delivering on his promise to make Washington accountable again to the citizens it meant to serve and will always fight for what is best for the American people. The reason having loyalists at both the Department of Justice and DNI is so very important for the president is that it allows him potentially to coordinate two key agencies of the government, secret intelligence and prosecution, towards his own political ends. This is exactly what he was criticized for doing in the summer and in autumn of 2020, with William Barr being accused of announcing politically motivated action and investigations, including to support the fiction of widespread voter fraud, and Mr. Ratcliffe with collecting and releasing information that is targeting Donald Trump's political opponents. The third leg of what would be an ideal triad for this sort of activity is the FBI director, Christopher Wray, who drew Donald Trump's ire in September when in congressional hearings he echoed the consensus of the intelligence community that the Russians intervened in the 2016 presidential election on Mr. Trump's behalf, that they were doing it again in this election cycle, that racially motivated violent extremism coming mostly from right-wing white supremacists was a persistent threat, and that widespread voter fraud was a non-issue. The FBI has been under siege since this past summer, according to a senior official who spoke on the condition of anonymity. The White House is using friendly members of Congress to try to get at certain information under the guise of quote-unquote oversight, but really to get politically helpful information about the election, the official said.